For the week of February 3rd, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 436, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New England, I'm Michael Giltz.
And let me guess, you're celebrating the Patriots victory, the New England Patriots who just won football's Super Bowl yesterday for the sixth time in under 20 years.
If I'm being honest, I'm celebrating the fact that a few years ago I learned New England is not an actual state, but just sort of an area.
Oh, I would have thought you knew that already. Okay.
No, no. I'm like, I've never been to New England. I was in Vermont when I said, I've never been to New England. They're like, where do you think you are? I go, Vermont.
Yeah, that's why everybody from like Connecticut to Maine roots for the New England Patriots.
Geography, not my strong suit. Football, also not my strong suit, but we do know the ratings. The ratings were at, looks like a 10-year low, which means only about 100 million people watched. It may actually fall below 100 million people, but, you know, big deal. It'll still be the biggest show of the year. The halftime show was the most boring and safe halftime show since Up With People in the 70s, that's for sure. But it's nice to know I can still be shocked. I actually was shocked. The game was on, and suddenly commercials were on, and I heard Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind. I was like, what? And I went out there, and they were using it for a Budweiser commercial. A Budweiser commercial. I was actually horrified. I found that was awful.
You know, Bob Dylan said, I'd be rolling in my grave if I was dead.
No, he said, thank you for the check.
Yeah, that's probably true, actually. Right. Because, you the whole point was that Bob Dylan, he'd never sell out to the man.
Well, you know, it was to promote the fact that they were using wind power at some of their factories to make Budweiser beer. But sorry, that's not what the song is about. It's not actually about wind power. It's about something else. So that was awful. But Atlanta was very exciting this weekend. Boring game, boring halftime show, awful use of a Dylan song. But 21 Savage arrested by ICE. This is an Atlanta rapper. He was arrested by ICE. And they said, this kid's not from Atlanta. He's British. This guy has talked his whole career about growing up tough in Atlanta, being the youngest kid to ever bring a gun to school. You know, he's a real rapper. It turns out he's actually British and overstayed his visa. And you're like, what? Is that true? Have they messed up? But no, just now his lawyer has confirmed, hey, he never hid his immigration status from the government. So he really is British. That's amazing. No, that's stunning. He's like an Atlanta rapper. He's like, I'm from Atlanta, born and raised, man. And no, he's like, hello, love.
Would you like a spot of tea?
Exactly. He came here at like 15 or 16 or something. Unbelievable. That was shocking. So that's big news. But what else are we going to talk about on this week's show?
Well, I just want to know, at what point can I rip my shirt off and have my wardrobe malfunction?
As long as you have enough ink so that it looks like you're wearing another shirt underneath, we'll be fine.
Yeah, apparently that's what you need because, you know, Janet Jackson rips a shirt off or part of a shirt off and it's a whole hoo-ha. And
that's because the world is afraid of women's bodies. Moving on.
Okay, well, moving on. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're still recovering from the Super Bowl weekend. By the way, so is the North American box office, which hit a 20-year low thanks to the national religion that is the gridiron. Despite the slump, documentaries made some headlines. So did Sony, which is skipping CinemaCon in April. At the same time, Netflix wants to get chummier with the movie industry, so it's joining the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. We've got more info on the 2018 box office from around the world, with Australia, Japan, and Poland all having some good news to share. Meanwhile, the awards season is red hot with SAG and the DGA weighing in, the Oscar nominations coming out, and a fight over best song ending before it began. And hello, MoviePass! They're making headlines again. Unfortunately, because the company faces a class action lawsuit. In book filter news, Michael has returned with his first pick of the new year. He got game, baby. Or rather, the lead of the novel he picked has game. In sexual misconduct news, Bryan Singer. Do I need to see anything else? Well, no. Bryan Singer faces new allegations. While Michael Jackson was the subject of a damning documentary at the Sundance Film Festival, Singer can take comfort in the reported $40 million he'll be making from Bohemian Rhapsody, a movie that he got fired from, so he'll have to actually try and collect that money. Good luck. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a closer look at the aforementioned Sundance. what the fest has to say about the movie biz overall. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times. You, our listeners. And the number one movie around the world is How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. $40 million on the weekend, $84 million worldwide. It's now open in 41 territories with still China and North America to come. So this movie is gaining momentum, getting good reviews, and doing solid box office all over the world. It should go right to about $400 to $500 million, just like the last two.
Yeah, I mean, in some territories, it's already in its third week.
Yep. It's weird. That's how a lot of movies open up around the world. It isn't just the big, you know, tent poles that open up everywhere at once. And number two around the world is Glass, the M. Night Shyamalan film, $21 million on the weekend. That's just about to hit $200 million worldwide. At number three is a film we've talked about before. It's a Korean comedy called Extreme Job. It's about cops who go undercover, and so they open up this chicken restaurant as part of a sting operation, and it turns out they're really good at making chicken. Becomes a hit restaurant. So it's a light comedy. It made $20 million on the weekend. It's at $45 million worldwide. And yes, I'm still a little short of breath thanks to that strep throat.
You know what? I think that this Extreme Job movie, I think that could be a remake.
Oh, absolutely. We said so at the time, I believe.
Yeah.
At number four is Green Book, which thankfully got a lot of Oscar attention and has really benefited from end of the year awards. That's now a profitable hit. It didn't look like it was going to get there for a while. $16 million on the weekend, $81 million worldwide. It cost $25 million to make, so it has now safely tripled its budget, and it's still got a strong ways to go. Who knows? This sucker could win it all. At number five is a French film. In English, they're calling it Bad Weddings 2. Or maybe a rough translation would be, What Have We Done to God? This is a sequel to an earlier French comedy. This is about four daughters, each one who marries a guy from a different religion. It was a big, big hit. Now in the sequel, all four daughters, for various reasons, are thinking about leaving France. The movie made $12.8 million on its opening weekend. And just like Extreme Job, this sucker seems ripe for remake for North America. And number six is Escape Room, the horror flick, $11 million on the weekend. That's going to pass $100 million worldwide. At number seven, much like Green Book, is The Upside, a touching film about racial and people with disabled bodies learning about each other. It's touching, it's sweet, it's wonderful. $9 million on the weekend, $83 million worldwide. Kevin Hart has himself a hit. To heck with the Oscars. At number eight is Aquaman, $9 million on the weekend, $1,107 million worldwide for that DC property. One of the highest grossing Warner Brother films of all time. That's how big a hit that movie is. In contrast, Ralph Breaks the Internet still has not tripled its budget. Good reviews, decent box office, is going to be okay, but certainly a bit of a disappointment for Disney. $9 million on the weekend, $485 million worldwide. At number 10, not a disappointment to anyone, is Bohemian Rhapsody. $9 million on the weekend, $830 million worldwide. And who knows, that could win the Oscar for Best Picture.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not after this past week.
Nah, I don't think Bryan Singer is even associated with him. I don't think anybody's avoiding the movie because of Bryan Singer. They just didn't give him a director nomination.
Well,
and I think he's certainly, Rami Malek, I think, could win Best Actor.
Well, yes, I mean,
of course
I agree.
He could. He's nominated, but I think he's probably the front runner at this point.
Yes, I agree.
At number 11 is Whitesnake. This is a Chinese animated romance, quiet box office in North America, also extremely quiet in China, where this movie took the number one spot with just $9 million. Very quiet time. They're just getting ready for the new year. That's about to kick in hard on Thursday. So a lot of big movies are going to be opening up in the next few days in China. This movie, Whitesnake, however, that's made $62 million worldwide. We don't know what the budget was for this film. It probably was a little modest, but if you do, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also email, that is our email address. You can call us and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That's right. See, we take a week off and we fall apart. At number 12 is Bumblebee, which has made $455 million worldwide. At number 13 is Clint Eastwood's The Mule. That's at $125 million worldwide. It still hasn't tripled its budget, but he's going to get there. At number 14 is Creed 2, which has now made more money than the original Creed. So there will certainly be a Creed 3 that has passed the $200 million mark worldwide. At number 15 is Deadpool 2. It's back on the charts because they released it in China in that PG-13 version. It made another $6 million on the weekend. It's at $785 million worldwide. I'm sure they didn't spend that much money to re-edit it and shoot the new scenes. They've made $42 million in China alone. So that's a successful thing. And now, of course, they're thinking Deadpool 3. They will probably release it right away in a PG-13 version. I think they should do that here as well. Why not make a little PG-13 version available if they think there's an audience? It will be interesting to see how it did side by side if it was released at the same time. You know, why not?
You know, certainly it would put an end to the big question filmmakers always have of, you know, come on, let me just do an R. It's not going to make that much more money if it's PG-13. Well, now they could say, well, I don't know. Remember Deadpool 3 when it, you know, they could actually, a studio could actually have living proof.
Well, but it's a special, every film's different though, of course. That's a film that wants to be an R movie. So how strongly it does PG-13 would be interesting, but I don't think it would be an argument to not make it R or whatever.
Yeah, I wonder if Fred Savage is like, hey, wait a second. You're releasing it in China. You said you were releasing a PG-13 version in the US and now you're making $42 million overseas.
I'm sure he's aware of all that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
At number 16 is Miss Bala, a remake of a foreign language film. That's at $6.7 million on its opening weekend here in the U.S. Number 17, A Dog's Way Home. That passed the $50 million mark. And number 18 is Mary Poppins Returns, another $6 million in the till. That's just at about $330 million worldwide. It still has not tripled its budget of $130 million. It's about $60 million away from that. It's not going to get a lot of Oscar attention, so I don't know if it's going to get there. I don't think so. I don't think there are any big territories left for Mary Poppins.
But it'll be fine because it'll have home video and you know.
Right. It's not going to be a money loser for Disney, but whether they'll pull the trigger on a sequel, I'm not sure. And number 19 is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. We know there are already two sequels and spinoffs to this movie. That's at $350 million worldwide. A great result for the movie. A great step forward for animation, that it's not just a kid's film or a typical animated movie. It has a cool, unique style. I think a lot more DC movies and Marvel movies, you know, should have animated spinoffs. It makes sense. DC's done a really good job with them for years. They've just released them direct to video. So here's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, really breaking ground. And I think at this point, it's the front runner to win the Oscar for Best Animated Film.
I agree, especially because of the diversity issue. I mean, it's got a diverse cast.
It's got everything. And number 20 is The Favorite, another $5 million in the weekend. That's at $60 million worldwide. One of the bigger flops in recent weeks is The Kid Who Would Be King, starring the son of Andy Serkis, Gollum. But okay reviews, not very good box office. It made $5 million on the weekend. It's at $18 million worldwide, and it costs $60 million to make. With the U.S. and England being its prime territories, it's already sort of fallen short there. The news is not good for this movie. I forgot to look this up, Hit and Run Squad. I couldn't figure out what it was. ShowWebX is the distributor. Don't know where this country this is in. I don't know what it's about. $5 million on its opening weekend. So that's a mystery to me. But you look down at the bottom, you have the Met. They always have successful movies, operas opening up. And the Met Opera Live, Carmen, that made $3.8 million playing in 9 territories around the world. But the closer here in North America, there is some big news in documentary films. A couple movies. First, Free Solo became the second biggest grossing doc released in 2018. It's now number 2 behind Fred Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? And then Peter Jackson, he has a big hit. Thank God he can put the Hobbit movies behind him. He oversaw the World War I doc They Shall Never Grow Old. That hit the top 10. It's been released in like Fathom events and special one-off showings. They've been doing that since last year, like December or November or something. And every couple weeks, you'll see, oh, there's another screening or another Fathom event. This week, they pulled the gun and they released it pretty wide, you know, like hundreds of screens all over the country. And it made a good amount of money. It made, what was it, $2.4 million on the weekend, playing on 735 screens. It's now grossed more than $10 million in North America alone. This is his World War I documentary film. I went to see it over the weekend with my mom. And, you know, the big news is that they restored this 100-year-old footage. They pulled out audio interviews from BBC Radio, combined it all into a film. But then the really exciting part is they colorized it. And they put it in 3D so it would seem more realistic. And I'm relieved to tell you that 40 years after Ted Turner, colorization still sucks.
I was like, come on. Yeah, you can bring, yeah, come on.
It's so fake and awful looking. When you have the black and white footage, and they did good stuff there technologically. It's not like I'm opposed to any technological innovations. They cleaned it up and they changed the frame rate, because old movies, you know, when they're filming with hand cranked film, it's kind of herky jerky. It's not at a
16,
natural.
Yeah, 16 to 18 frames per second hand crank. And right. Then 24 is what looks natural to us. And then, of course, as you get, you know, 60, you don't see, you know, yeah. Shutter.
So they sped up the frame rate. They inserted some frames to make it more smooth, to make the footage look more natural, so they didn't look herky-jerky. Great. I have no problem with that. That makes sense to me. You know, it was a limitation at the time that they couldn't overcome. And it's true. They could have shot in color if they had color, but they didn't. But the black and white footage looks so much more real, and the people look so alive. And then when you colorize it, it just looks fake. And the 3D was so pointless. Oh, look, there's a guy behind the other guy. You know, look, there's a pile of corpses. You know, it just was, you can't even imagine what they're thinking. It's so fake and awful looking that they just ruined whatever they might have accomplished with the story that they were telling and the footage that they had access to. Happily, all the restored footage has been donated to the museum, so it'll have hopefully a future life. But, you know, colorization does not work, even today, 40 years later.
Well, you know, you asked about Hit and Run Squad. So that is a Korean film about a police lieutenant. She, you know, it's a female lead, and she used to work for the National Police Agency, which is kind of like the FBI. And she gets demoted to the Hit and Run Squad. And then, of course, there's like a big hit and run case with a Formula One driver. So...
Nice. Yeah. Well, thank you for filling me in on that. Here's my question for you. Fill me in on this. Sony is skipping CinemaCon in April. And when that happened, I thought, ooh, I wonder what Sperling thinks about that.
I think, wow, that's pretty remarkable. They must really have, you know, one of two things is going on here. One of many things is going on here. One, they want to save some money. It costs roughly...
No.
You don't think so? No. $2 million?
No. $2 million is what it approaches to go to CinemaCon. Please. That's a TV ad. That's two ads.
I'll be honest. I think it costs way more to go to CinemaCon, in my opinion. I can't imagine.
That's what a reporter said.
Yeah. I think it costs $2 million maybe to put on the show reel. Maybe. I mean, I think that's a rather low.
But that costs that much. Oh. They've got the reels. They've got the execs. They got to buy hotel rooms. What do you think would cost so much?
Flying in all the stars.
Blah, big deal. How much can that cost?
Throwing the big party afterwards.
$20,000 plane ticket. You know, hotel suites. Still, you're not getting $2 million is a lot of money.
Well, the other thing I think might be going on here is they may not actually have anything good. I think
they have Spider-Man Far From Home, they have Men in Black International, and they have Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood all coming out this summer. Their argument was, in fact, we've got such good stuff, we don't need CinemaCon.
Right, and I think that was where I was headed with this. So it's either not that great, or it's so good.
Not a great lineup of stuff.
Yeah, or it's so good that they're basically like, you're going to play it anyway. I mean, I've been waiting for Disney to say, guys, we really don't need this. As it is, they show up, they put up a slide that says, here's our slate for the next 3 years, which has like 50 Star Wars movies, you know, and 20 Pixar movies, and, you know, a bunch of
exhibitors
Marvel.
So we know the studios are sort of over it. Disney treats it dismissively. Sony can't be bothered to show up. How does that make the exhibitors feel? They're obviously not going to say, okay, I don't want Spider-Man Far From Home. But do they feel dissed, or do they feel like, yeah, this thing has already run its course, we don't need CinemaCon anymore? What's going on?
I think that when it comes to, you know, consolidation, you've got Regal, AMC, Cinemark, and, you know, when you're talking to Regal, you're talking to Cineworld. And when you're talking to AMC,
talking to Odeon. They own subsidiaries. That's okay. But how are they feeling about the studios treating CinemaCon dismissively?
Well, I think the smaller guys are really upset about it. The bigger guys don't care. And let's face it, you're getting 50 to 60% of your box office from the bigger guys. So it doesn't matter. As far as the smaller guys, you know what they'll do? Sony will bring everybody to Los Angeles that matters. They'll fly them all in and do a weekend where they show them all the trailers or they show them one of the movies early.
Well, if they're going to do that, why don't they just go to CinemaCon?
Because they feel like, you know what? They're just one of many at CinemaCon. When they do this whole LA junket thing, the exhibitors feel more special.
Yeah, but they don't have time to go five times every season to the studios and fly out there, you know?
Yeah, well, what winds up happening is you'll see that two studios will do it together. So it'll be like, you know, Disney,
Sony.
Sounds
like CinemaCon.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Well, I think it's short-sighted. I don't think there's any reason to diss it. I don't think it'll hurt them long-term, but it doesn't help them.
No.
To save a couple bucks, big deal. Well, Netflix is joining the MPAA, and I think a lot of people were confused. I think they thought Netflix was joining NATO, which would have been interesting. But the MPAA, of course, they work a lot on piracy around the world and getting access to markets like China. So they have a lot in common with what Netflix wants around the world. So they have a lot of common interests. So it really does make sense, doesn't it?
Yes, especially on the piracy front. But really what it is, I mean, this is an organization that is funded and put together by the six large studios and a few others like Lionsgate, etc. So, it's kind of like saying, okay, I'm buying a ticket to the country club.
Right. And they're very happy to have a new deep pocket say, yeah, we'll keep funding the MPAA because Disney and Fox just merged, for example.
Right. Correct. So basically you get membership as a studio. And I'm sure that there's a sliding scale based on how much of the market you take up. But still.
So Netflix pays $4 because they don't release anything.
Well, right. So I'm sure that, you have to ante up a certain minimum. But, when you have Fox and Disney combining, it's kind of like you have one of your customers going away.
Absolutely, yeah. So they are happy to have Netflix join. And Viacom is happy to have Bob Bakish as their CEO. Sure, he got a modest pay cut, but he's still getting $20 million. That's just the latest CEO paycheck for the year that we've heard about. But more importantly is the worldwide box office. There's some good news in multiple territories, aren't there?
Yes, although we're going to talk about this in a second. Just the Viacom thing really quickly. Keep in mind how much Leslie Moonves was getting. Okay? And Viacom owns.
Don't make it sound like he's getting pennies. It's $20 million, dude. Don't make it sound like he's always a miser.
It's an obscene amount
of money that he should not be getting paid.
No head
of a publicly traded company should be getting $20 million. Les Moonves should not have been getting what he was getting. Nobody at any of these companies should be getting what they're getting. It's absurd.
Okay, well, let's see. I think you may have missed what I was trying to get at there, but let's move on to the worldwide box office.
Well, Les Moonves was getting more than Bob.
Right, exactly.
So what's your – well, I'm saying don't act like this guy's not getting that much. What's your point?
My point was the guy who's running the subsidiary is making more than the guy who's running, you know, the company that owns both.
Who cares? Well, but CBS is more, you know, doing better than Viacom overall, right?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So the guy making the big bucks is pulling it in, is making the big bucks.
Right.
But worldwide box office, we got some good news.
Speaking of big bucks, 3.6%. You know what that is?
Well, I don't.
It's the amount that the Australian box office grew, which you might think, hey, that's not a lot. Keep in mind, it's a country with like 30 million people in it. So,
well, the percentage increase doesn't matter whatever the size of the country is. But yeah, the only bad news there is that they've got more movies. They have lower ticket prices. They had modest growth. That's good. But they really do not have a strong local box office right now. They basically had two movies made most of the money, and one of them was a Hollywood film, essentially. So the Aussie local box office, not strong news there. Japan, on the other hand, they were down modestly this year. But put it in context, it's their third highest year grossing of all time. They grossed above $2 billion. Admissions were at $169 million. They had a very good year. It's the third biggest of all time. So the fact that it was mildly down from last year, which was the second or first biggest of all time, who cares? Keep it in context. The fact is that Japanese films have held 55% of the overall gross. So they have a majority of the box office, the local movie. So that's great news. But the biggest movie of all in Japan was Bohemian Rhapsody. They loved this movie. It made $95 million. It opened, and then the next week it grew bigger and then bigger and then bigger. 5 weeks in a row, this movie grew in attendance and box office. It was just a phenomenon. They were crazy about Queen. And finally, in Poland, they had a great year as well. The box office hit a record high, a record 59.7 million admissions, a record $300 million at the box office, and great news for local cinema, the top four films were all Polish. So good news in Australia, Japan, and Poland, especially with the fact that Japan and Poland look like they have some thriving local cinema. And overall, the international box office had good news too, didn't it?
Yeah, international box office, it rose 1%, led by growth in North America.
And isn't that stunning? Led by North America, the biggest market in the world, the most mature market, and still we led the worldwide. That's unbelievable. That's crazy. So yeah, you can look at a list. We have a link in our show notes to the top 100 films internationally, not worldwide, but internationally. And you'll see a good chunk of them. China had two in the top 10, five in the top 20, and 26 films overall. One out of every four films that were the biggest internationally came from China, Hong Kong, or co-productions between those two countries. So that's great for China. India had three films in the top 100. Japan had four. Korea only had one. A little surprising, but you just have to keep in context. They're doing great in their local cinema. They are really producing hit after hit. It's just hard to get onto that international and worldwide box office list because the budgets and the grosses are so big. So many of those movies are Hollywood.
Yeah, I think, certainly, look, Poland, you see a country like Germany where the box office is declining and has been waning. Yeah. Poland, Italy, these are countries with big piracy problems, so it's good to see that their box office is actually growing.
Absolutely. And of course, here in North America, the box office can get a boost from the Oscars, and it is award season, and if you think you know who's going to win an Oscar, you're a liar. You're a liar.
I know who's going to win an Oscar.
Who?
It'll be one of the nine or eight or whatever
very
it is
good.
Nominated films.
So who won at the SAG Awards?
Black Panther. They won Best Ensemble, which is kind of like Best Film, right? I mean, isn't that kind of like... Rami Malek won for playing Freddie Mercury. And Glenn Close won for her portrayal of The Wife.
The Wife.
Yes.
Yes.
And Mahershala Ali and Emily Blunt. And Emily Blunt won for A Quiet Place. They both won supporting actors, Mahershala Ali for Green Book. And I think that Emily Blunt was probably the most surprising.
Oh, there you go. But yes, so you think, okay, Black Panther, maybe that's the one. And then the DGA came out and they said, best director is
Alfonso
Cuarón. So you're like, I'm sorry, every single award is different than the last. It is really one of the most wide open years I've ever seen. I'm very happy that Bo Burnham won Best First Feature from the DGA. That was cool. But what did he win for?
We should say he won for Eighth Grade.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's on my best of the year list. So, you know, the Oscar nominations came out when we were away. Netflix is clearly a player. And just like all these other awards, so many rules, quote unquote, have been broken about picture and director and actor and all the things you look for in the trends. We really would defy anyone to make any predictions. However, their desperate attempt to bring in some more big blockbuster movies into the best picture list, well, it certainly worked this year. Eight films were nominated for best picture. Three of them are very big hits: Black Panther, Bohemian Rhapsody, and A Star is Born. So if audiences will tune in more when they actually recognize the names of the films, well, we got them this year, so we'll have to see how it looks. And frankly, aren't they glad they did not have a best popular film category this year? Wouldn't that have looked just plain stupid?
Yeah, I mean, what would they do? They'd have Black Panther in both. They'd have Bohemian Rhapsody in both. A Star is Born in both. It's like, oh, well, you didn't win best film, but you're popular. You're popular.
Yeah,
you're not the valedictorian,
most likable.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I was going to yell and scream at the Oscars for their stupid decision to just have two of the five best songs performed, not just because it's insulting, but because it was dumb. Who wouldn't want to watch Emily Blunt trying to sing live on the Oscars? You know, she's not a professional singer. She's never really done that. But suddenly her song from Mary Poppins Returns is up there. That's an exciting moment to me. Who doesn't want to see Jennifer Hudson, an Oscar winner, singing a song from the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary? And Tim Blake Nelson, dude-ed up like a cowboy, singing When a Cowboy Trades His Spurs for Wings from the Ballad of Buster Scruggs? Those are just drop-dead fun Oscar moments. And yet they were just going to show two, but everybody banded together and they were going to say, if you don't let all of us perform, none of us will. And so they're just doing some half-assed lame medley, I think, for the other three. But we will see Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper doing Shallow, which will, of course, win Best Song. And Kendrick Lamar and SZA will be doing All the Stars from Black Panther, which is a really good soundtrack.
I mean, do you honestly think that there's any way Shallow could lose?
No, that is the only, I mean, at this point, I feel like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is becoming very firm, but the only thing I would lay money on is Shallow. That will absolutely, if that, that will win. There's no doubt about it.
I would lay money on one other category. One other. Best foreign language feature to Roma.
You know, and you can get messed up there. I don't know. That's not, Capernaum is a heart tugger. I don't know. I feel only in my friends do I feel a backlash to Roma. People are like, you know, that's a lot more and more people see it. They're like, it's pretty. But, you know,
yeah,
I don't know.
I've actually been hearing that more and more. And I guess my take is it still might win Best Picture. And here's why.
Oh, sure. Of course. Anything.
Not because it's the number one on everybody's pick, but because it's the number two of everybody's pick.
It's like number nine on mine.
Oh, wow.
It ain't number two on mine. Yeah, no. I mean, you know, yeah. I don't like it. It's not on my best of the year list at all.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No, I got a lot of problems with that film. But I do not have a lot of problems with the Grammys. They are taking place on Sunday. Unlike the Oscars, which will have no host, the Grammys will be hosted by Alicia Keys. That means I got to finish my best of the year list. I always try to get it done before the Grammys. So by Friday, I'm going to have to post my best albums of the year list. That's exciting. But they've got eight albums up. Eight albums up. I don't know what's going to win that one either. This is the year of awards where I have no clue.
Could you imagine, okay, the envelope being opened and them saying, Post Malone for Beer Bongs and Bentleys?
That's a hugely popular, critically acclaimed album. It's not one of my favorites, but yes.
I just think like the fact that somebody would have to stand on stage and say Beer Bongs.
Well, it's the Beavis and Butthead in you coming out again. I don't know who's going to win, but I'd love it if Brandi Carlile won or Drake would make sense. Janelle Monáe would be awesome. The Black Panther soundtrack, frankly, is very good. That would be interesting. It could win the Oscar and the Grammy in the same year in a way. And Kacey Musgraves, I did not like her turn to pop, but that has to be the most critically acclaimed, one of the most critically acclaimed albums of the year, Golden Hour. So any of those four or five would make a lot of sense to me. So, well, you know, I'm going to be intrigued and I'm going to tune in.
Although Brandi Carlile's album got a lot of love.
That was the first one I mentioned. I thought it was great. That's right near the top of my list.
Well, okay. So, you know, I was thinking the other day about how what we don't see anymore with the, you know, physical media disappearing, we don't see the Columbia Record House sending me an album a month. You notice that?
That's true. And of course, you know, with the streaming, you get to all you can listen, right? That's nice. And that was kind of the cool thing about MoviePass, right? All the movies you could go see.
Right, exactly. So I guess MoviePass, if we have to explain what MoviePass is, subscription movie going, okay? And they decided $9.95 per month for all the movies you could watch. And everybody said at the time, you know that's not financially feasible, right? And guess what? It turns out that it actually wasn't financially feasible. So
now they're trying to relaunch themselves and they're thinking of even going back to one movie a day. And now what are they facing?
Well, a bunch of people are saying, hey, we're going to sue you. Well, yeah, but it's a class action lawsuit.
Well, two. It's a couple so far. Two.
Okay.
They're inviting other people to join them, but it's just two people.
They're saying, hey, this is a bait and switch. You said one thing. That it was one movie per day. Then you changed it on us. We couldn't get out of our annual contracts, and there were no movies that we could go see anywhere.
Yeah, they said there were so many blackouts, so many restricted times, so many restricted movies that it ended up over like the year they saw three movies. And they asked for a prorated money back, and MoviePass was like, no, that's not how it works. So they're suing, and you know, you're told you get to see a movie a day, and they're like, well, not that movie. Well, not today. Well, not at that time. You know, it's frankly, I think it's a good lawsuit. Not that there's any money to be had, right? MoviePass is kind of practically out of money.
I don't know. Period. I mean, they just bought all these billboards in Times Square. That's like $3, $4 million for the month. I mean, that's really expensive.
They have billboards in Times Square?
Yes, they do. They. I saw the CEO's, or maybe he's the executive vice president. I don't know what his official title is. He's up there, senior management. He posted on LinkedIn, video of their billboards in Times Square.
Re-promoting the brand. Well, that's like we said, they're relaunching themselves, trying to get back into people's good graces. The lawsuit won't help.
You know, there was some speculation that they lost close to 58% of their subscriber base after August of last year.
Yeah, I quit, of course.
Yeah.
I don't know who would still be on there unless they had an annual subscription and couldn't get out of it.
Hello.
I don't know anybody who is still paying their month. I don't know anyone who's still paying their monthly fee. If you're month to month, I don't know anyone who has stuck with it. Why would you? You can't go see anything.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, unless they actually make it worthwhile where you can go see, you know, a movie or two or three a month, there's no point.
No, I don't want to pay $10 for two movies a month. I can go see movies for $5 on Tuesday. I don't need two movies a month or a movie a month. I wanted a movie a day. That's what you promised.
Well, they're not offering
that.
Let's move on.
No, yeah, we don't need to discuss MoviePass. They're dead. They're facing a lawsuit. That's
well, if they're not dead, they're dead to you.
Yes, they are.
Well, I guess let me ask you something. What isn't dead to you when it comes to books? Because you know, every week you over there on BookFilter.com, you kind of read all the books that are being published, and you tell us what
every
we should be reading.
One. Yeah, that's right. I read every single book.
Yeah, exactly. It takes a long time, but it's a good thing. What is the speed reading course you took?
Evelyn Wood.
Evelyn Beep. Wood. Yes, it's good that you did that because now you can read everything that comes out and then tell us what we should be reading on BookFilter.com. But what should we be adapting to movies or television shows that came out in the last week or two?
Well, I have no doubt that this book has already been optioned. There's a blurb from Salman Rushdie on the cover. Big quotes from lots of different really talented writers. Like I think Colin McCann is in there. Other people are in there. So this is a highly touted novel. It could have been promoted as a young adult book, but it's gone into the fiction section. It should be shelved in both categories and the sports section because the book is The Falconer by Dana Zapnik. I apologize if I'm butchering your name.
It's Dana Zapnik.
How the hell would you know?
Because the C is going to be silent there.
Always?
Yes.
Well, all right. Well, so spake Spurling.
So spake Spurling. That's a tongue twister.
Yeah. So it's a coming of age novel set in New York City in the early 90s. Our heroine is Lucy. She's a really good basketball player. Her best friend is Percy. Lucy's, parents make money. She lives on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, but Percy's from real money and he's her best friend and they play ball on the streets of New York all the time. They both play in their high schools, of course, best friends for years. She does have a crush, probably an unrequited crush on him, which has never been spoken about, but this is not a book about a girl with a crush on a boy, not by any stretch of the imagination. She's her own person. The book is so good at capturing like female friendship and high school and somebody figuring out who they are. She has other friends, like two older women, like in their 20s, who are artists and live in a loft and create all this cool, crazy art. And she goes to protests and she goes to clubs and tries to eat for the first time. It's a real coming of age book. She's such a good character. She's so vivid. She's so great. I know this will become a movie. It's just a terrific, terrific story. And really, Dana Zapnik, I look forward to seeing what she does next. Not to put pressure on her. Her first book just came out. But really, it's definitely one of the best debuts of the year. So The Falconer by Dana Zapnik. Check it out.
And I know somebody's going to write in and say, actually, the true pronunciation is Chapnik.
And there you go. I hope they do. And another book note. The film Pet Sematary, a new adaptation of the Stephen King novel, comes out in April. So, of course, like in the next few weeks, there's a new paperback with a movie cover tie-in coming out. I'm like, of course. And I go to look at it. I'm going to promote it and put it among my picks maybe for that week in sci-fi or something. Maybe $18 for a new paperback of Pet Sematary, a book that came out in 1983. You know how much it is on Kindle, on Amazon? $13. At least it isn't more than the paperback, but $13 for a 36-year-old book that came out decades ago. I know it's Stephen King. I know he sells a lot, but that's crazy. That is just, it just, this stuff drives me nuts, I have to tell you.
Well, you know, it's free, actually, that book.
How so?
At the library.
Well, of course, they always have been. That's a different issue. Yeah. And the library is great, and I use it all the time. But, you know, you're trying to reach people. You're coming out as a movie. Why you wouldn't make the Kindle version like $5 for like a month, a couple months around the movie just to get people to read the book? Why the trade paperback would be this big, fat book and cost $18? That's just ridiculous. But also ridiculous is sexual abuse. And Here we are talking about sexual misconduct news. Now, I know you didn't see this film, but what was the reaction from other people who went to Sundance that saw the Michael Jackson doc? What was your general takeaway from how people felt about the movie? Were they like, wow, that's really devastating. Makes me really rethink Michael, or what was the deal?
That was the devastating part. Now, mind you, this was a documentary that is in two parts. It's going to be on HBO. It was shown one time, the first day of the festival, in the morning. And it's 4 hours long. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was also shown in one of the smaller theaters, smaller venues. So not a lot of people could see it. And those that did were like, wow, it's convincing and it is somewhat devastating.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to separate the artist from the music. I mean, that's how I always feel. Just because I listen to someone's album doesn't mean I love them as a person or think they're admirable. But it took me a long time before I could listen to Michael Jackson's music again, really, and enjoy it. I'm there again, but it was a while after it became so obvious that he had hurt people and molested children and was paying them off with millions of dollars. So I'm sure that will happen again for some other people, but it sounds like it's a really nuanced, thoughtful film about sexual abuse and how it, you know, affects you your whole life and why you might lie about it and why you might, you know, testify in court when you're 15, 16, 17 or tell your parents it didn't happen. There's two base main guys that are involved in this documentary who talk about their journey in their life where they find like, yeah, no, he actually did molest me. So it's upsetting, confusing. And a film like this, I'm really looking forward to checking it out.
And meanwhile, you had Corey Feldman up in Park City for Sundance. Saying, hey, I knew Michael Jackson. I hung out with Michael Jackson just like those kids did at the same age. And you know what? I know a molester. I've been molested and he did not molest me. So he was not a pedophile because I know So he came to Michael Jackson's defense.
Well, that's unhelpful.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
An expert on pedophilia, and the fact that he wasn't molested doesn't mean other people were.
Correct.
Nor can you. Clearly, if he doesn't think Michael Jackson going to national television saying, of course I took nude showers with other people's children, that's perfectly natural and normal. If he doesn't think that's a sign of beep, 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 something's wrong here, then he's a fool. So, you know, he's suffered a lot too. I feel sorry for that, but it's a shame that he felt the need to denigrate other people who are coming forward. But what about Bryan Singer?
Well, Bryan Singer, filmmaker of X-Men films and The Usual Suspects, and now Bohemian Rhapsody. I guess The Atlantic came out and said, hey, you know, there are all these underage kids, one of whom was 13 years old, the 13-year-old actor from Apt Pupil. Three other people.
They did a year-long investigation, two reporters for their outlet, which then squashed the story, and they brought it to The Atlantic. And they basically did a very long, thorough investigation, and got four people on the record talking about the fact that they were sexually molested or sexual misconduct of Bryan Singer. They all described a similar thing. Here's some drugs, here's some alcohol, and then the sexual advances or molestation. So very sad. Singer denounces it, says it's not true, it's absurd, they're homophobic. No, I don't think so.
So here's a question. What other outlet turned it down?
I forget. It was was it Vanity Fair? No, I forget who it was. I would have to look that up. But it was just another outlet, and they got cold feet, or somebody higher up squashed it.
Is it in the magazine, or is it in? Because I have the magazine here. I guess I could kind of thumb through it and see if it was in the magazine or whether it was online. I guess it doesn't matter really, but I just
wonder. It doesn't. That doesn't make any particular difference, I don't think.
No, not at all. I just wonder if, you know, with a story like this, whether you go to Dead Tree Media.
I don't know what that means. Atlantic has a website and a print magazine.
It was a softball. I was throwing you a softball there. So you go, I don't think it's a big deal either way.
Oh, sorry about that. It is time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. What's our first story, Sperling?
Well, it's about Hulu. So Hulu has been busy. If you want access to the most basic Hulu with ads, okay, you know, you now only have to pay $6 a month. Ad-free basic Hulu remains $12 a month, but if you want their OTT over-the-top TV bundle, you pay $45 a month for 60 channels, which is actually, you know, plenty in my opinion. More channels, but more money. Want a DVR in the cloud and as many screens as you want? That'll cost another $10. In short, a lot of options. Hulu now claims more than 1 million people subscribe to its TV bundle, what used to be known in the old days as, you know, pay TV. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It seems a perfectly reasonable step forward. They got added more channels. They slightly raised their TV bundle. And just again, we are not talking about cord cutting. We are talking about long overdue competition. People have been paying inflated prices for their pay TV, $150, $180 a month for a cable package with, you know, internet and stuff. And they had faced no competition. So they had nowhere else to go. Most cases, it was a monopoly. So now finally we're seeing competition. And so prices are coming down. Is that going to affect the pay TV companies and the pay cable channels? Yes, it is. But tough. You've been getting, you know, crazy amounts of money for too long, and that's ended. But this is not cord cutting. It's just a long overdue competition in the pay TV space. And thank God for it.
J.D. Salinger died in 2010. Big deal or big whoop? No. a documentary film was released afterwards stating the reclusive author did indeed continue writing his entire life and that multiple novels and short stories were set to be published in the years ahead. Nonsense, said Singer's son Matt. Absurd.
Salinger.
What did I say? Singers?
Singer, like Brian Singer.
Oh my God, I've got Singer on the brain. Well, Salinger's son Matt said, this is absurd. It's ridiculous. This is not true. Now he says, well, maybe not ridiculous. That might have been a harsh word. While Matt disputes some of the details about what was written, he states unequivocally that his father wrote continuously for the rest of his life, that they are compiling the massive material as fast as they can, and that it will all be published someday. Soon, in fact. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal if you're a Salinger fan. It's a fascinating story, one of the most famous authors of all time. Why they felt the need to comment or say anything about the movie, I think that was just insulting and absurd. They should have just shut up. You know, don't say anything. Why pretend it's not true when they knew perfectly damn well it's true, however different the descriptions of what books and novels and stories were written may be. So that was just stupid of them. It's insulting to the filmmakers. It was ridiculous because now they look like fools. They were basically lying. Even if there was some, you know, loophole that they used, you know, why bother? So, wow, it's coming out. There's all these books coming out. Wouldn't it be awesome if, like, right before we died, suddenly people found out we had a whole second set of podcasts that we recorded all these years, and it's all going to come out after we die.
Wow.
We'll have a whole second set of podcasts, you know, unexpurgated, the cursing, the fights, the crying. That'd be exciting.
That would be more like the Beatles movie we're going to talk about.
That's right.
Now, all I can say is it's alive. And you might be wondering, am I talking about Frankenstein? No, I am not. I'm talking about SoundCloud because they were on the verge of collapsing completely. Beloved by acts, spawning almost an entire genre of rap, it simply wasn't making any money. But an infusion of cash, firing a lot of employees, and refocusing on what it does best, you know, which is help acts create and share music, has allowed SoundCloud to turn its fortunes around. They still lost money in 2017, about $58 million, but overall revenue rose 80%. And that revenue has two sources. Subscription revenue grew 90%, and advertising revenue grew more than 50%. They insist 2018 did even better. We'll have to wait and see. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to say a big whoop because they're still losing money. I'm glad that it's moving in the right direction, but call us when you've got a really good story to tell.
The UK theater scene is a little murky by US standards. On Broadway, the grosses are published every week for every show. Everyone can see how many tickets were sold, how much money was made, the potential gross, the total money made, and, you know, they can see everything. It's just like the movie box office. No secrets. In the UK, this is seen as disturbingly tacky and frightening and all-around distasteful. Publish the grosses? Never! But once
a year... Bad show.
Yes. Once a year, though, the curtain is pulled back and we can see how the UK theater world is doing. The Society of London Theatre even took the bother of publishing info on both the West End and touring at the same time, so all those touring productions. We've only got figures for the past 3 to 5 years, but the news is generally good. Regional theatre, those, you know, touring productions as well, had a slump, but it is back on track. The West End also had a modest attendance slump in 2016, but is powering ahead. Overall, the entire UK theatre scene generated $1.6 billion in total grosses. The West End sold 77% of all tickets available, while The Road was weaker, selling just 61% of all tickets available. 2019 will probably be down since a number of West End theaters are shutting and, you know, we talked about this for those long overdue renovations, especially in the bathroom area. Mm-hmm. Big deal or big whoop.
Right. So we're looking ahead and saying, hey, don't freak out when 2019 is down. It's good news overall. Here's a hilarious statistic. The average West End ticket price was $60.
Wow.
Oh, my God. I could go to I love London theater. It is so inexpensive and so much more accessible. You can always walk up and get a ticket, even to the hottest show in town. It's really great. And on Broadway, one of my favorite shows, the terrific Tony-winning musical The Band's Visit, is closing. They made back their money, and now they're closing down in April. So if you get a chance to be in New York before it closes, I would definitely check it out. And they're going to start touring as well. So a success story on Broadway.
Beatles fans can rejoice. The Fab Four, or the surviving loved ones, have signed off on a new documentary film by director Peter Jackson, who apparently is now a documentarian.
I hope he does a better job than with They Shall Never Grow Old.
Well, he's going to colorize it. He's actually going to make all of it black and white. He's going in reverse.
Exactly.
He's getting full access to 55 plus hours of footage shot during the recording of their album Let It Be. That's the same footage used to create the all-but-invisible film Let It Be, a sad document of the band's breakup that hasn't seen the light of day in decades. Jackson will combine the filmed outtakes along with hundreds of hours of audio to create the ultimate fly-on-the-wall movie about the recording of that album. He insists it's actually pretty joyous and fun to watch. But not to worry. Once the new film is out, a completely restored version of the original film, Let It Be, will be released. I think they should have just let all of this be. Big deal or big whoop.
No, I disagree. The footage is there. Why not make a new documentary out of it?
Because then I couldn't actually make that joke. That's why.
No, well, there you go. I don't know why Peter Jackson, but I'm just glad it's not Ron Howard. No, I didn't see the Ron Howard concert film that he made of the Beatles. Maybe that was good, too. I really am not sure why Peter Jackson, but great. Martin Scorsese can't make all the 60s documentaries. So, you know, it's a slam dunk. I don't see how you can make a bad movie out of all this footage and stuff. I'm sure it'll be interesting. I hope they make some multimedia stuff where you can see a lot of the footage available, hear a lot of the audio beyond what they use in the film. But I'm excited to see it. I'm especially glad they are restoring and releasing that original film and not pulling a George Lucas and trying to pretend it never existed. So good on them for that. They want to put up a new, happier version now. Okay, whatever. That's fine. I'm a Beatles fanatic. I will go see it. But thank God they are preserving history and making sure that other film is available as well.
You mean the one where they were all fighting?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
The Lindsay Hogg film. Yeah.
Yeah. Spotify, by the way, is making it easier than ever for someone to mute an artist. And by artist, we mean you, R. Kelly. They've just added a button that appears on the menu of every act on your phone. It says, "Don't play this artist." Click it and you're done. R. Kelly is gone. Spotify will automatically remove that act from any playlist you may access. Change your mind? Just go back and click on it again. Hey, I don't believe I can fly, okay? But I do believe I can block an act I don't want to hear from. By the way, I'm looking at you, Ted Nugent. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's a reasonable thing to make available. Why not? I think it's even distinct from the idea of artists you morally object to. If there's somebody you really hate, you don't want to hear REO Speedwagon, mute them. So I think it's a useful tool, puts the fan in charge, gets the company out of the way. Makes sense to me. But just make sure you don't mute the Backstreet Boys because they have their first number one album in nearly 20 years with DNA. This is another success story for combining a concert ticket with a CD sale. You buy the concert ticket, you pay a little extra, you get a CD, and that's why they sold about 230,000 copies of their new album this week. Yeah, so good on them.
So have you looked at your phone while you're using Spotify lately? Because I've noticed that there are animated, like, there's like animated album art.
No, I haven't.
It's pretty remarkable. Like, it's in portrait mode, And there's all these, you know, I was listening to the Beirut album, and there's all these, it was Vampire Weekend, a couple tracks from Vampire Weekend. And there's like an ant crawling across the screen or a frog.
I know they've always had like lyric videos and lyric stuff and information and factoids and stuff. I just never look at all that. But all right.
Okay.
Is it generated by Spotify or by the artist?
I'm sure the artist gives it to Spotify and Spotify then, you know, puts it up.
Okay.
Is digital journalism dead?
Yes.
Okay, well then let's go. the future of news media seems to be dying on the vine. HuffPo and Yahoo News, both owned by Verizon, laid off a ton of workers. BuzzFeed laid off 250 people. Mike.com fired its staff and then sold itself off. And now Vice has cut 10% of its workforce, about another 250 people. Those clicks are not coming fast enough. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. There's what? No reason because the fact that you're digital means you're suddenly impervious to the market. And I think it's a bad market and there's a lot of constriction and too many players. So, you know, you're like, I'm digital. I'll always grow. No, you know, so there's no reason to think that would be true. HuffPost got huge, massive, and they needed to pull back. Whether they're going to be able to stay, you know, relevant, I don't know. New York Times is doing good. Good for them, you know, but I don't think it means traditional media wins and digital loses. I just mean some people grow too far, too fast, and now they got to pull back.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, how will it affect you? Well, the Sundance Film Festival is what we're talking about, and it looks like you will be able to see every single film that played at the Sundance Film Festival, either on Netflix, Amazon, or in theaters.
It was a huge market this year. It really was. Amazon set the tone. They spent more money on movies this year than any studio or outlet has ever spent before in history at Sundance. So that's kind of amazing. I feel like they and Netflix are the 800-pound gorillas in the room.
Although
the
way Netflix didn't buy that many films up there this year. They bought like two or three. And although granted, American Factory, which is a film kind of like gung-ho. It's about it's a documentary, first of all. And it's about a Chinese company taking over an American factory and the culture clashes that occur.
Right. Yeah, they bought that.
$3 million, a documentary.
That's way too much money for a documentary. And they spent $9 million on the Zac Efron film Extremely Wicked about this serial killer, Ted Bundy. So right. Yeah, they were a player, but this year Amazon was the big gorilla in the room. But I just think the streamers are the people with the deep pockets right now. Every few years, it's somebody new. It's the Weinsteins one time. It's somebody else next. Now it's them. This is just the cycle. I don't think it's like, oh my God, what's going on? It's like, it always happens. 5 years from now, it'll be somebody else making a bunch of noise with a lot of money, right?
Well, right. And notice that you haven't heard Fox Searchlight in that mix. Mm-hmm. We all know why. They're not buying films when they don't know if they're going to be around next year.
Right, yeah.
So, but normally they would be there. So would Sony Picture Classics. They were there this year. They bought Where's My Roy Cohn, the documentary about Roy Cohn.
Right, but they never spend big bucks there. They're the people who spend the right amount of money, and you know they're going to be honest and fair and take care of your movie, and you're going to make money every step of the way if they do.
Correct. Well, most of the time, yes, they do make money. They bought.
No, I'm not saying they always make money. I'm saying if they make money, you will make money. There's no gamesmanship. There's no whatever.
Oh yeah,
They're smart. They're nimble. They're lean. And if they make money, you're going to see your money.
Right. They also brought the David Crosby "Remember My Name" documentary,
which makes
me wonder: is he on Sony Records? I wonder.
As a solo artist, I don't know.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't make SPC want to pick up their movie more.
No, not at all.
Because they're not going to get a piece of the soundtrack necessarily. But I think one of the other big news was you were saying that you felt like Sundance is always diverse, but it just got diverser.
Yes. It were diverser-er. Yes. Yeah. I mean, look, they've always had female filmmakers. They've always had filmmakers of color. Yeah, they've always had, you know, gay films, LGBTQ films. So that's never been an issue.
Physically disabled films, you know, every possible, you know, minority or unheard voice, you know, that's where Sundance lives.
Right. And this year it was on display. I mean, I would say most of the films that caused a big ruckus, at least, Brittany Runs a Marathon was a big winner there, at least in its acquisition.
Won the audience award.
It won the audience
biggest
award.
Winner, period. Knocked Down the House, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez film. That won Best Documentary Audience Award. And Brittany Runs a Marathon won the audience award for Best Film. In my mind, female directors dominated the awards given out by the groups, correct, but the audience award is where it's at. And Brittany Runs a Marathon and Knocked Down the House were the big winners. And Brittany Runs the Marathon, $14 million sale to Amazon. That is a big ticket. They also bought The Report for $14 million. They bought Late Night, the Emma Thompson film about a late night talk show host written and co-starring Mindy Kaling. They spent $13 million for the U.S. rights only.
That's, wow, that's probably about right. That film, if they put another $13 million in, okay, to market it, and they'll probably put more like $20 million in, that film could probably top out at around $50 million, at least $50 million.
Well, from the outset, I'm looking at these numbers, $50 million for Blinded by the Light by New Line, about a kid who falls in love with Springsteen's music. Whenever you see a $10 million or more at Sundance, I think, mistake. I don't care if it pays off. I'm just saying that's just not a good bet. That's
well, the big
that's too much
paid
money.
Off. I mean, like you.
I don't. Of course, once in a while it pays off. Most times it doesn't pay off. It's too much money. You're overpaying for these films, and I don't know why Amazon is doing it. It's too much money.
Well, The Farewell. Here's a film where I think it was priced fairly right. The Farewell was picked up. Is it A24? I forget who.
I think it might be them. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember who picked it up.
They spent about $7 million on it.
Yeah, $6 to $7 million. Perfectly priced. It's a film that is directed by Lulu Wang about, and Awkwafina is in it. She stars as an American girl, although she's actually Chinese. She moved to America. She goes back to China to visit. She goes back for a wedding, and I put that in air quotes because it's kind of a fictitious wedding that is set up to allow everybody in the family to say goodbye to their terminally ill grandmother, which sounds really like, oh my God, this is a morbid tale. The thing is, nobody has told the grandmother that she's sick.
Yeah, right. So it's A24 picked it up and they spend $6 to $7 million. And I would go, whether it works or not, that sounds like a reasonable amount of money to pay. $10 million, $14 million for a Sundance comedy is not a good bet. I don't care if it actually ends up working. Most of the time you're going to get screwed. That's too much money.
Well, I will say you said that The Farewell is a reasonable and it's a good film when it is released. Yes, it is mostly in Mandarin. Well worth seeing. It is a really good film. Honey Boy, Shia LaBeouf's comeback movie. He plays his own father in a semi-autobiographical film. Mm-hmm. And he just disappears into the role. I mean, you can tell it's him. I mean, but he's very, very good. And Amazon picked it up for $5 million. They could easily make $15 million on that film, easily.
Any other takeaway from Sundance? Any sense of like, okay, there? I mean, with the money being thrown around, clearly it's there as a market. You felt like you saw some good movies. The media coverage was good. Did you just feel like, all right, yeah, Sundance has got its groove on. There's a new generation of people in charge. Redford sort of did a drive-by. Hello, I'm here. Goodbye.
He's been doing that for years.
Right. So this is it's going to last way beyond him, obviously. And you feel like the new generation of people making programming choices are doing a good job.
Yes, I think there are some really, you know, what makes a film festival like Cannes, for instance, is the films that come out of it, right? The films they program and the films that go on after being programmed to be big hits.
Right. You feel more just critically acclaimed. You feel like I want to be there because I want to be the first to see some really good movies that are going to come out this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is always the fear, oh my gosh, I'm going to miss something. But then, you know, you stand in line.
You always do.
Yes, there's no way to see everything. So I missed Blinded by the Light because I was seeing something else. I missed Clemency, the winner of the dramatic category, U.S. Dramatic, because I was busy seeing something else. I was busy, I think, seeing The Souvenir, which won for, you know, world drama. And, you know, there's just no way to see everything. And, you know, in some cases, you see films, at least in years past, that you never see again.
Oh, well, that's always true of festivals. But you went this year. It's been the first time in like 3 years. Are you going to go back next? Do you feel like, okay, yeah, I need to come back?
This was a very good year, in my opinion. Not just for the acquisitions. Yes, for acquisitions, it was phenomenal. I mean, they spent a boatload of money. Amazon just was like, you know, spending galore. But the quality of the movies was really good. A movie, Luce, L-U-C-E. A film about a teenager who is adopted from Africa by Naomi Watts and Tim Roth, by a white couple. And, you know, he's kind of a valedictorian type, but is he? And, you know, a teacher, his history teacher, is trying to find out whether he's really, you know, the person he says he is, or whether he's hiding something. It's a phenomenal movie. Now, it's based on a play, an off-Broadway play that did fairly well. And so it was adapted perfectly. And you have some of these new distributors. A24, not so new anymore. They've already won Best Picture for Moonlight. But
Neon picked up Loose.
Yes, Neon picked up Loose. And Neon is run by the owners of Alamo Drafthouse. So it's like their distribution arm. They just were nominated for an Academy Award for Border, for, I guess, his best foreign language film, or maybe it was best makeup.
It was not best foreign language film.
Yes, then it was best makeup. But they're kind of coming on strong. So while you might not have the Weinstein Company anymore, you do have others filling the void.
Right. And so you're going to definitely go back next year. You feel like, okay, yeah, I don't want to miss this. I need to be here.
You know, every year it's a, do I go? It's so expensive to go. So, of course, the way you, you know, buttress that is you wind up sleeping on floors and sofas, and you're sleeping with 50 people, because that way, you know, you kind of defray some of the costs. This year I was up there for a press event that had nothing to do with Sundance, but it just happened to be at the same time and in the same place. So, hey, why not go to Sundance? I do think after this year I would go again. And you know, I've been going since the 1990s. And I took 2 years off, and I think it kind of helped me gain my sea legs again, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, I miss Khan, and we're going to be missing some people because it's time for the obituary section. There's always more people that we can ever cover, but there are four people in particular we wanted to talk about. One I'd never heard of, Reggie Young. He is a studio guitar legend, and he died at 82. He's the sort of musician that everybody who's a hardcore music buff has known about for decades, but me, I've never heard of him. And when you see the list of some of the songs he's played on, you go, oh my God, you know, he played on The Letter by the Box Tops, Suspicious Minds by Elvis Presley, Sweet Caroline by Neil Diamond, The Dark End of the Street by James Carr, Son of a Preacher Man by Dusty Springfield, which immediately makes me go, you know, you can immediately hear his guitar. Hooked on a Feeling, Drift Away, Always on My Mind by Willie Nelson, and about 10,000 other hits. You know, he's really just somebody you have in your record collection, you've listened to all your life, but until he dies, you don't really appreciate how woven he is into the pop music fabric.
Well, and then there's Jonas Mikus, the godfather of the avant-garde. He died at the age of 96.
Good for him. My mom just turned 90. She's laughing at him. I'll beat him. That's what she's saying. I mean, the New York Times said it best. They said he is the leading champion of the type of film that doesn't play at the local multiplex. We are talking avant-garde.
Yeah. And, you know, I know him as the head of the Anthology Film Archive in New York.
Right, which is still running, like Film Forum and some others. This is a hardcore place for seeing art films and films you can't see anywhere else. Really obscure movies and avant-garde stuff by fringe artists that will never be seen in a multiplex, never even get on Criterion. But he founded Anthology Film Archives. He did the journal Film Culture, which published the Signal essay on auteurism by Andrew Saris, and he helped found Filmmakers Cooperative, a distributor of films of the type of stuff that he does. He was the first film critic for The Village Voice. I mean, the guy really had a great life.
And he died at the age of 96. James Frawley, a director, died at the age of 82.
Yeah, I think he is the polar opposite of Jonas Mikus. He is a pure mainstream guy. Interesting, fun little career. He directed a lot of TV shows and a fair number of pilots, including The Monkees. He did their pilot and won an Emmy for that, and did a fair chunk of their shows. And they did lots of other TV. He did the pilots for Ally McBeal. He did a pilot for Ed, which was a sweet show that ran about 4 years, and lots of episodes of other shows. Never a ton of episodes. You know, some people do like a show and they stay with it, but he was just here, there, and everywhere. But did a lot of episodes of Cagney and Lacey, including their reunion TV movie. But the funny thing about this guy, there's a mystery at the heart of his career. There he is making these TV pilots, doing Emmys, lots of TV movies.
And then he does a movie.
He did an earlier movie, The Big Bus, which did nothing. And then Jim Henson plucked him out of nowhere and said, I want you to direct the Muppet movie.
moving Why? Right along.
How? Who knew? But he picked him. Great success. Tons of critical acclaim. Commercial hit. And he never made another movie. Never. Not one. What the heck? What a bizarre mystery. He just went back to doing his usual Magnum PI and, you know, Grey's Anatomy, a couple episodes here, a couple episodes. I mean, how could you never follow up that movie? Maybe he just didn't have that drive, or people knew it was just a fluke, or I don't know what. But, you know, he made enough good TV pilots that, you know, he could claim to fame. You know, The Monkees, Alan McBeal, The Muppet Movie, that's better than most people.
Yeah, it's surprising. You're absolutely right. Once you make a movie like, The Muppet Movie, if it's a success, sure. Most of that was probably attributed to Jim Henson, but still, as the director,
those Muppets didn't direct themselves,
right? You kind of get you get the stamp of, hey, we can give this guy money and he's not going to blow it at least right, once.
A family film, yeah. But no, he didn't even make another Muppet movie. Yeah. Who knows? Knows the story. He might just be an easygoing guy who was not hungry for grabbing more and more and more. That's the impression I get, and he did some great work.
Well, so did Michel Legrand, the Oscar-winning composer who died at 86. He worked on films such as The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
That's his masterpiece, of course.
Yes.
A great, 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 great musical. I love it. Delightful, different, so unusual. He made 9 films, or 10 films, with Jacques Demy, the French director, including The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. He won 3 Oscars, I think. One for the song The Windmills of Your Mind, one for the score for Summer of 42, another one for the score of Yentl with Barbara Streisand. So, you know, he did The Three Musketeers, the classic version from the 70s, which I love. He did 2 films for Orson Welles, F for Fake back in the 70s, and then to top it off perfectly, he did the score for The Other Side of the Wind when it just came out.
Well, I guess he's also, of course, as a musician, won Grammys and nominated for Emmys as well. And Tonys. Well,
yeah, no, he's an EGOT nominee. He won an Oscar, he's won Grammys, and he was nominated for Emmys and Tonys. He did the score for TV's Brian Song, that classic tearjerker, and Ingrid Bergman's A Woman Called Golda, who's a really good jazz pianist. Unlike James Frawley, Michel Legrand was hungry for work and worked nonstop from beginning to end of his career, working right up until he died at 86. So a cool, interesting career.
Well, we actually called the death of NBC Sports, really. We said the NBC was getting out of sports. And Raul Buril actually got in touch with us via Twitter. And, do you want to read what he wrote?
Sure, he's going to take me to task. Hi, Sperling and Michael. I wanted to reach out because I felt that Michael's characterization of NBC sports programming in relation to the Bob Costas story to be inaccurate. Michael said that NBC had little to offer other than the Olympics every couple of years. Well, even if it was just that, that's still huge in terms of revenue and ratings every 24 months. But they also have Sunday Night Football, NHL hockey, and a number of sports channels, NBCSN, the NBC Comcast Sports Regionals, Golf Channel, the Olympic Channel, and all the programming such as Premier League Soccer. NBC's NBC Sports division is the envy of everyone except maybe ABC, ESPN. Surely CBS wishes their offerings were that robust. NBC has a vast army of on-air and behind-the-scenes professionals working at NBC Sports Group. Sadly, Bob Costas has been relegated over the last several years. The Rio Olympics were particularly hurtful, but that's politics, not a reflection of waning sports coverage. Anyway, I didn't want to post this publicly as I felt it might sound like bashing. I love you guys, and one flub doesn't deserve a public admonition. Well, Sperling decided, yes, it does. No, except we're delighted you put in a contrary choice. Arguing that, you know, maybe Bob Costas just sort of lost influence as he got older and older is different from saying NBC didn't have a lot of great sports programming. I kind of respectfully disagree because I felt like NBC, the network, used to have like the Wimbledon and regular programming and baseball. And, you know, he loved baseball. He did good on Wimbledon. He loved all this stuff. And he got pushed aside on the Olympics, which is, again, only every 2 years. So I felt like the NBC network had really pulled back on sports. They've got all those channels, but, you know, popping in on the sports, on the golf channel just isn't the same as being on NBC. But yes, NBC has good programming. You make a good argument that they're second only to ABC and ESPN. I guess ABC, ESPN is so dominant that it's hard to think. But I don't know. I don't think Fox is too envious of NBC. They've got a lot of good sports.
They have, think about it. They have the NFL. They have baseball.
But as Raul would say, a lot of that is also on their sports networks, not on that proper network. But they do have a lot of baseball and football on Fox itself.
Correct.
So, yeah. NBC Sunday Night Football, number one in the country, but Bob Costas ain't playing that game. No. Hockey, not really his thing. He can cover anything, I think, and now I'm probably ignorant. I'm going to find out he covered hockey for 30 years or something, but I think of him as baseball, you know, the Olympics, even Wimbledon to a degree. So I felt like NBC sort of had faded away. But you make a good argument, and that they do have a lot of good sports programming in a lot of other areas, and maybe Costas just got older and got pushed to the side, which is a shame. But we do appreciate your writing, and we love criticism because we like to hear other voices. So thank you for reaching out.
Yes, and you can do that by writing to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that email address can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. And in fact, that is where you will find ways to subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. We can be found. And please do rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do, and it, of course, helps the people find the show when you do that. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, as well as that way to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, like Raul, you can reach out to us at Showbiz Sandbox. So I guess Raul actually reached out via Twitter. So again, at Showbiz Sandbox is the way to follow us. On Facebook, we can be found facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, well, every week he can be found on a new and exciting website. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's artisticintegrityisblowinginthewind.com.
I'm not even going to try and figure out what that means, but I will tell you.
Don't sell your song to Budweiser. That's what it means.
Oh, okay. Well, what if, did you, by the way, you know, before I tell them where they can really find. By the way, before I tell the audience where they can really find your coverage of the entertainment industry, did you see the ASMR?
I don't even know what that means.
It's the ad where.
Oh, yes, I did. Yes, I did. Yeah, I forgot what that was called. That was hilarious.
Michelob Ultra or something like that. Yeah, I was like, are you serious? It was the quietest commercial and the entire room fell silent.
That's awesome. They're all listening.
Yeah, everybody was listening. It was the craziest moment.
Well done. Well done.
Well, if you do want to find out what Michael is covering in regards to
just
the entertainment industry,
go to michaelgiltz.com.
Yes, go to michaelgiltz.com.
Michaelgiltz.com.
Or, you know what? If you want to be, you know what you should be reading, go to bookfilter.com because that's where all of, you know, his groups pick. Come on. Come on. I'm just trying to finish.
Sorry.
Anyway, some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Show this week, Sperling. I thought it went really well.
Shouldn't we be brushing against the microphone or something like that as well? I don't know how ASMR works. It doesn't work for me.
We talk very quietly.